Go on the 2016 valuation report.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the board. As agendized, Siegel Consulting, Paul Angelo, and John Monroe are here to present the annual actuarial evaluation as of December 31, 2016. We will be presenting from the handsome blue binders here. We'd like to encourage the trustees, you know, to read the reports. And the way that we structure this, for those of you, I know we have a number of veteran trustees here. We have a couple who maybe are seeing this only for the first or second time. We'll jump right into in section one. This is built in sort of a pyramid form. Section one is an overview. First, there's a summary in text of what happened from last year to this year, then a couple pages of numbers. Section two, a little more detail. Section three gets into some of the demographics and some of the background. And section four is the do not try this at home section, where we have a list of all the plan provisions and all of the actuarial assumptions. In section one, the first page is largely boilerplate, so we'll just flip to page double I. And you'll see the way the report is built. In the left column, you'll see reference pages. So the idea is for each of these comments, you can flip to that page and see more detail on how that's developed. And that's what we'll be doing today. We're going to be flipping back and forth between section one and the pages there in the notes. Now, I will tell you, as just as a matter of overall and introduction, when John and I prepare for these meetings, you know, we always try to think, okay, how could anyone possibly pick a fight with this valuation report, because that does happen. And we came up empty. This is a fairly bland report. It was a somewhat uneventful year. You had good investment experience. The rates are relatively flat. Many of them went down. If anything, the only thing that's a little bit quirky, perhaps, and we'll talk about this, is even though the average rate was fairly stable, if you look at the actual rates by cost group, you see a little more volatility. That's probably the only thing in here that might engender a question. Other than that, this is just a good example of a routine actuarial evaluation report in a relatively routine year, fairly stable rates, fairly stable experience. And then also, both for the veteran and the newer trustees, we invite questions as we go through. This is a very loosely scripted presentation, so if anything occurs to you as we go through, just feel free to raise it in the context of each item. So with that, we're going to start way at the top of page double I. There's a reference there to your amortization policy back on pages 70 through 82. Now, why are there 13 pages of this? It's because you have a lot of different cost groups, and we have a different amortization page, amortization schedule for each of those. But if you flip way in the back of the report, at the end of section three, right before the section four tab, on page 81, you'll see this long amortization table. This is a key part of your funding policy. This board in 2007 restarted the amortization of your unfunded liability. And then since then, each new layer of unfunded is amortized over an 18-year period. That's the board that was selected, the period that was selected by the board. We like to say you can actually, it's like reading the rings on a tree. You can see what happened each year, whether there was a gain or a loss. You see the amount of the initial gain or loss. You see the amount of that chunk of unfunded that remains to be paid. You see the number of years remaining and the annual payment. And if you take each of the date it started and compare that to the number of years remaining, you can back into that these are all 18-year layers. And so here again, this just gives you an opportunity to see if someone says, where did your current unfunded liability of $1,178,000,000 come from? You can actually go back and show not only where each dollar came from, but when, what was the cause, and when that will be paid off. And the only sort of black box that remains is that initial one, which was the top ones. You'll see there's four layers that are all 6 years. That's when the unfunded was restructured back in 2007. So again, this is a very good picture of, again, where the unfunded comes from. One of the things that we watch for as these layers start to drop off, you see something called tail volatility. For example, 6 years from now, you're going to have a reduction in employer contribution rate in today's dollars of about $70 million. How did I come up with $70 million? Well, you see 141, which is the top right, right? That's going to be fully paid in 6 years. But then you've got a couple of credit layers. You see a 56 credit and a 15 credit, and then a little tiny credit down further. If you net those together, 140 minus about 70 is a net of about 70. So there's going to be a reduction in employer contributions for the plan in total that in today's dollars is about $70 million. That's the sort of thing you can predict when you have your amortization schedule in front of you. So again, this is more of an object lesson in one of your established funding policies. It doesn't require action today, but it's something that we monitor. Okay, with that, we flop back to section one. Now we'll start going into the results for this year. I'm still on page double I. These bullets are fairly standard. We look at the valuation value of assets, then we look at the change in the employer rate, then we look at the change in the member rate, and then we look at the effect of asset smoothing and investment performance. So we're going to start with overall the funded ratio of the plan increased slightly from 84.5%, 86.5%. That's on a smooth basis. On a market value basis, it also had an increase from about 82.5 to 84.5. The dollar amount decreased slightly from $1.3 billion to $1.2 billion. And then over in the margin there, page 35 is a history of the unfunded liability. But the one that we focus on, we probably spend more time on this next page than any other, is page 69, where we reconcile how did we get from last year's unfunded to this year's unfunded. That is in section 3 on page 69. When we looked at that amortization schedule, what you noticed is, you know, your longest layers are 18 years, and you have layers as short as 6 years. When you amortize an unfunded as a level percentage of pay, which is what most public sector plans do, including this one, you can have something called negative amortization, where the unfunded actually goes up before it goes down. Whether you have negative amortization or not depends on the length of the amortization period. And when you reviewed your funding policy in 2007, at that time, there was a break point at 18 years. And actually, the reason that the board chose 18 years was to avoid any negative amortization. So now, you have layers either 18 years, which is pretty flat in the first year, you basically pay interest, but you also have layers as short as 6 years, which means you're deep into paying off that unfunded. Well, you see that at the top of this page. We start with last year's unfunded of $1,311,000,000. And what happens to an unfunded is you add a year of normal cost, you add expected expenses, you then take out contributions from members and employers, and you adjust everything for interest, and that gives you the expected unfunded liability. This is what the unfunded would be if the new contribution rates went into effect exactly on the previous valuation date, that is December 31, 2015, and if all your assumptions came true. My point here is you see here a decrease from $1.3 billion to $1.2 billion. That's the positive amortization that is built into that amortization schedule that we just looked at. So your break-even number, your no gains and losses number, shows steady progress toward paying off the unfunded because of the way you structured your amortization policy. Well, we always say that's what happens if all the assumptions come true. Guess what? None of the assumptions ever come true. I mean, the assumption, there's always variations. So now we go through the major drivers between what was assumed to happen, what actually happened. Excuse me. Investment return was a little bit more than expected. Now, that's on a smooth basis. We'll look at the difference between the market earnings and the smooth earnings. We had a small gain there. Now, this next one's interesting. Actual contributions greater than expected. What happened? Did somebody just send us too much money by mistake? No. You have what's called an 18-month lag between the date of the valuation. You know, we are reviewing right now, which report is this, the December 31, 2016 valuation. These rates go into effect July 1 of 2018, 18-month lag. And back in the days when rates were going up after the 2007 market debacle under five-year smoothing, we had 5 years of losses in a row. Every year, the new higher rate would not go into effect until 18 months after the valuation, so you'd have a contribution loss because during those 18 months, the computer thought we were getting the new rates, actually paying the old rates. A couple of systems in California adjust for that. However, this board does not. This board says these are going to average out. Well, this is the flip side of that coin. From 2 years ago to last year, the rates went down. And so those higher rates from 2 years ago stayed in effect for 18 months. And that's why you actually had $12.5 million of contributions greater than the valuation would have calculated. This is exactly that same 18-month lag, but now it's seen on the other side. And we always like to have it turn out that things that, you know, look bad when you're processing losses but look good when you're processing gains, those really do balance out. So this is an example of how that works over time. The other items here are ones that we've seen seen before. We actually had higher than expected individual salary increases. We did not see that for the 3 or 4 years after 2007. Now we're starting to see salary increases greater than assumed. That means that we are now projecting higher benefits than we did last year, so that's a loss. We also had higher than expected COLA increases. Now, John, maybe you can comment on this one a little bit. You know, inflation's been very low. We had gains for a few years, but particularly in Northern California, which is the CPI that you use to determine your COLA increases, we actually had higher than expected inflation in the last year.
Yeah, the inflation change in the last year in the Bay Area was 3.5%, which is much higher than it has been in recent years. So what this means is that recent retirees, they will get a 3% COLA, for example. Our inflation assumption is 2.75% per year, so we assume that they will get 2.75% COLAs each year in the future, but that recent retiree actually received 3% this year. So that creates a loss. That member also gets a 0.5% COLA bank, and that also creates a loss as compared to our assumption. So higher inflation as compared to what we expected. That's what created the loss.
John, while you're on that, do you have any sense of what part of the basket of goods and services rent is in the Bay Area? That's where we have skyrocketed relative to the rest of the country.
Yeah, I do not have a sense.
Short answer is going to be on that. It's going to be no. Yeah, that is not something, Mr. Phillips, that we look into. You know, we basically take that CPI statistic.
It's just a given.
It's just a given. That's right. It's a data point.
Correct me if I'm wrong. And I may be wrong. Last year when we did this, you were suggesting 3.0 for the COLA, and as a board, we decided to knock it down to 2.75, which has suddenly now created a deficit down the road.
Yeah,
possibly.
Yeah. You know, it was 3 years ago, or whenever it was.
Well, it was last year.
Oh, I'm sorry, just last year.
Oh, my memory's good!
Yeah. Last year, boy, you know, time flies. Yeah, we had we are currently recommending 3%. The only assumption that we recommend consistently to all of our clients is the cost of living, because it's a macroeconomic assumption, and you can't really have a different answer in Alameda than you do in Contra Costa. So we recommended 3%, and you as a board adopted 2.75, and we did comment at the time.
Yeah.
That leads to, this doesn't mean it's bad or wrong. We're really clear on this.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you, we are looking real hard at 2.75. Every time we have an actuarial audit, the other actuarial firms say 3% seems kind of high. So just so you know. So it's not right or wrong.
For me, I just want to keep it in mind.
Okay? Yes, sir.
And next year, if we're looking at the same thing, I want to think about, wait a minute, maybe we need to do some changing in this area.
Yeah.
Okay. I understand we need a little time. We need to see how it flows. So.
Yeah. Okay. And it does affect.
I just wanted to refresh, especially those who are new to the board and weren't here last year when this occurred, that they're aware of it now.
Right. And it's because you have tiers with a 3% maximum COLA. You know, back when the inflation assumption was 3.5, mm-hmm. when it went from 3.5 to 3.25 to 3, that did not affect your retired liability, because we assumed the greater of, sorry, I said that wrong, we assume the lesser of the 3% that's in your formula or whatever's assumed. So if the assumed is above 3, we value it at 3. But the moment you drop the assumed below 3, now we're going to revalue retired liabilities. We made that point at the time. That's actually why, I believe, compared to the recommended assumption, the assumptions that included the 2.75 inflation mm-hmm. were actually slightly lower cost. than the ones at 3. So somewhat ironically, because we think about the effect on the discount rate.
Yeah.
Excuse me, folks. Where lower inflation means lower assumed return means higher costs. But lower inflation also means lower salary growth, which is lower cost. And when that teams up with lower inflation meaning lower COLAs, when the salary growth and the COLAs team up against the discount rate, it's basically a tie.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that means somewhat, a little counterintuitively, any year when you actually pay the 3% COLA tiers, when you pay them 3%, that's not a break-even event. That's actually an actuarial loss. That's what we're seeing here. That is,
I mean,
not
as a retiree, I'd prefer to have the 3% and have the half a percent in the bank. But yeah, as a member of this board, it's worth noting what that has done.
That's exactly
and what
right.
we'll do in the future.
And remember, and we did have at least 3 years, John, I think, where almost every system that we work on in California had gains on the COLA.
Yeah.
Because we were assuming 3 or 2.75, and they were coming in at 1.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have gains some years, you're going to have losses some years. But the break-even COLA, actuarially speaking, is no longer 3. It's 2.75. So that's all built into that little number there.
Okay.
And in 2 years, we are going to be having another experience
sure.
study and looking at all the actuarial assumptions.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we can see how the next few years go, and the board will
yeah.
revisit this one.
That's why we
yep.
go a little. We don't jump right, like, you know,
right.
now.
Yeah.
I got it.
I will tell you, though, something of a preview. We're going to be hard-pressed to find a justification in the analysis for a higher, for moving the COLA assumption. If anything, the pressure is still going to be either to stay at 275. The idea of going in these days,
okay.
going from 275 back up to 3, that's a very low, low probability outcome.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay?
Yep.
Okay, well, we got more on here. So the next one, so salaries higher than assumed produces a loss. Then they had the COLA, and we actually looked at both two of your demographic assumptions. We actually had a mortality gain on retirees and beneficiaries. Now this is, you know, this is something in the data. This could be something about timing of when deaths are reported, but based on the data that we got, we actually had more deaths than assumed. That's also a little counterintuitive, because when we did the experience study, we went to a new mortality table. We put in a projection scale to project future mortality improvements. That doesn't mean, though, you're not going to have the occasional year when the experience, well, this is where actuaries get their sort of morbid reputation. You know, it's good for the plan. It's bad for the retirees because they died. So we actually had more deaths than expected, so we had a mortality gain. That doesn't mean we're going to suddenly go and change the mortality table, but it does mean that, you know, that those margins and the new table that we put in were more than adequate to cover your actual experience. Sir.
Paul, about 3 years ago, I can remember being at conferences when the new thing, the mantra that was being talked about and spread was the phenomenon that people were living longer, and so all the actuaries were hitting all of the major conferences and talking about we need to really look at this again and so forth. I think it was yesterday, the day before, I read a piece in Bloomberg that just the opposite seems to be happening, that people are now, there's been a trend observed that people are dying sooner, sort of reversing that extended mortality trend. Do you have a comment on that? Or
I do. We saw that maybe started about a year ago, there was a study. One thing you got to watch out for is that though, now I don't know the Bloomberg one in particular, but those tend to be general population mortality statistics. And those include people who do not get up and go to work every day. And so, and some of that, some of it is statistically is drug abuse, some of it is suicide because of the recession. But the tables that we use are something of a select population because they're based upon pension data, which means these are people who had a full-time job and then retired with a pension. That's going to tend to be a more select group. So what I've seen so far is these sort of general interest articles on mortality improvements reversing have not necessarily been in the employed population, but more in the general population. So that might be one reason for the difference.
With this particular study, was in fact about the employed population, and I think the spin on it or the angle was really about private pensions. So it was about company pensions as opposed to public pensions. But the issue is the same, it seems.
Right. Well, there's another wrinkle on that then too. The difference between corporate plans and public plans is this. For corporate plans, the mortality table that they use is specified in statute, and every plan uses the same table. So when that table changes, all the liabilities move, and they move the same amount. In contrast, in public sector, even though we use a standard table, we customize it to your individual experience. So just because a new table comes out doesn't mean that we are necessarily suddenly all going to change to a longer-lived table the way the corporates do. So that's something always to keep in mind. Even though we start with a standard table, we then adjust it to your actual experience. So you're not going to see in the public sector this sort of one-size-fits-all universal remeasurement of liabilities of all plans just because a new table gets published. So it's less dramatic of an event. Nevertheless, the actual standard of practice says that you have to describe how you are anticipating future mortality improvement. So there is still a presumption, and the data still bears it out that that's happening. And that, I think, is longer-term data than what's showing up in some of these. But I think the Bloomberg article was probably, since it's Bloomberg, right, is probably more focused on the corporate side, and that really is just a regulatory issue because it's applied universally to all plans. I haven't done corporate practice in a while. Mr. Phillips is going to correct me here.
Well, my recollection is that the adjustments we made were gender. Basically, that women live longer than men vis-a-vis the mortality table. I was just curious about other adjustments that you make in customizing. In other words, what are you adjusting in broadly in customizing the standard table?
Well, because it's used for the valuation and not to determine benefits, we are allowed to use sex-distinct tables. So we actually look at males and females separately. So we take the standard table, which comes in a male version and a female version, and then we adjust the male table to match your male experience. John, check me on this. And we adjust the female table to match the female, although it may be for some plans of some size we pull those together. Let me throw that one to John.
Well, for this retirement plan, we didn't need to adjust the table. There's no set forward, set back. I mean, we were able to use the RP 2014 mortality table. Now, we do project mortality improvement going forward, but for general members, we did not need to adjust the table.
Yeah. Although, I want to be clear, it's only because your data said we didn't need to. So right. I would say we adjusted the table to your experience. It turned out to be a zero adjustment. But that doesn't mean that we just use the stock table off the shelf. That was a derived result. But we do look at experienced males and females separately, John. Is that true?
That's true, and we look at experienced general and safety members separately.
Right.
For safety members, we did need to adjust the table.
My long back recollection is we started with single and adjusted for male-female, and there was a huge, and this is all on the private side, there was a huge public reaction that we were somehow being unfair to females by doing that, because the assumption was that it was more expensive because they live longer. The other side of that, of course, is life insurance, where females would win by the same evaluation that they live longer, so the cost of the life insurance premium would be less. But this goes back a few years, and I'm remembering basically a single table, not sex distinguished, where we had setbacks and set forwards.
Well, you're going back to 1984, the Norris decision in Arizona. This is an important distinction because we use sex distinct tables for determining the employer and the member contribution rates. Okay, sorry, no, for determining the employer contribution rates. However, for determining member contribution rates and for determining member benefits, like optional benefits, we use a unisex table. Because it is against the law in determining the benefits, it's against the law to distinguish between men and women. So maybe, Mr. Phillips, you're remembering, is in the early 80s, there was a Supreme Court decision that said for plan administration, you have to go to a unisex table. So if you go back to your experience study last year and go to the section on mortality, and it talks about we're recommending a male and a female table, and then there's a section that says for optional benefit forms, we basically take the male and female table and merge them into a unisex table because by law, we have to use a unisex table for plan administration, even though we can still use sex-distinct tables for the valuation. And that all dates back to the early 80s and that Norris decision.
Great description. Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul, well, since we're talking about mortality, can you comment on the work being done on the public sector mortality table? Because I just heard that an exposure draft is coming out next year, a final report maybe in 19, and there's already been some sessions and some conferences discussed, and I don't want folks being alarmed in any way that, oh my gosh, what's going to happen when these come out?
Right.
We've already been adjusting.
The key I keep going back to is they can come up with all the tables they want. We are going to customize it to your experience. Now, if only from a perception standpoint, you know, right now we're using what's called the RP2014 table, thank you, and it's based on corporate pension data. There's no public sector pension data in the development of that table. Well, why are you using it? Well, because it's the most current one we have, and again, we customize it to you. What the Society of Actuaries did, and we actually have, there's a group called the RPEC, the Retirement Plan Experience Committee. There's a member of that committee who's in our office, Eva Yum, so we have our little pipeline in there. They are now doing a study based on public sector data. A number of large systems in California contributed data to the study. So they're grinding through it. It's an enormous, you know, labor-intensive number crunch. So they're going to come out with a set, another set, and they'll have to come up with different letters instead of RP, I don't know what they call it, PP. And that will be a table based on public sector experience. We will use that most likely, one, because it just looks more credible, but remember, we're going to customize your experience anyway. So I don't think we're going to see a big night and day change in your cost just because of the publishing of the new table. I would not expect so. But it will, it's going to, at least then we won't have to go through this explanation. Well, why are you using a table based on corporate data when we're not corporate? But again, the Society of Actuaries decided to break it into two projects. It's very slow moving. It's all volunteer staff. And so, I've heard the same timetable. They'll probably expose it sometime in 18, probably effective sometime in 19. Just not a lot of mortality. The one that's in some ways more, your costs are more sensitive to is not the base table as much as these projection scales. This is where we're anticipating future mortality improvement. The Society of Actuaries seems to be finding their way on this. You know, they did these are called the MP, mortality projection. They did one in 14, which assumed a lot of mortality improvement. Then they did one in 15, where they got some more data from Social Security, and that actually scaled back the rates of improvement, which would mean lower costs for your employers. And then they did the 2016, which is even a little bit shorter. So right now, we're seeing more variation in the projection scale than we are in the underlying table. And I'm going to have to check, John, I don't know if you know, the current project, I know that they're developing a new base table for public. Do you know, are they working on a separate projection scale for public? I'm not sure on that. That would probably make more difference than a change in the underlying base table. I'm not sure on that. But you're right, that is definitely out there. But I keep going back. We customize the table to your experience, so we do not expect any sort of automatic jolt in cost just because they publish a new table. Did you hear anything along those lines at the conference you attended? I haven't seen any of the we usually get all those PowerPoints after it's over. I just haven't had a chance to look at any of them yet. Yeah.
No, I mean, I think the key takeaway is just that public sector employees tend to live longer, and so there might be some concern when folks are hearing, oh, there's this public sector mortality table, and everything else that we've been using is based on corporate, so, oh, no, what's going to happen to us? But since, you know, Siegel has been tailoring it to our experience, it's not going to be this big, scary thing.
Right.
I just wanted to convey that to trustees if you're going to sessions and you're hearing topics on concerning this, which you probably will be.
In fact, you know, John just mentioned that last year, The RP 2014 base table, which is the corporate table, turned out to match your experience, because when we went to do our adjustments, we made no adjustments. So, you know, at least in that case, your experience did align with the RP 2014 table, even though it's based on corporate experience. Yeah. So it's all very much data-driven. Okay, we're going to spend this much time on every page in this report. Just want you to know. So I hope you brought in lunch. The only other demographic that we looked at was retirement experience. People retiring a little bit later than assumed. And again, we tune this assumption up every 3 years. Add all that together, in addition to the positive amortization. Remember a half hour ago we talked about the positive amortization at the top of this page. In addition to that, you had another $50 million of net gains leading to your current $1,187,000,000. So, you know, it's not going to drop to zero fast, but this is steady progress toward paying off your unfunded in absolute dollars, not just as a percentage of pay, but in absolute dollars. Okay, back to section one. The next page that we will look at, this is on, or back on double I, at the bottom, it talks about the average employer rate.
Now, but it made a good point.
Before we jump to page 32, because we're going to look at a reconciliation of the rate, just like we just did a reconciliation of the unfunded. Before we do that, let's talk about just how complicated this plan is. If you go to page 19, which is in section 2, you know, we're going to talk about the average employer rate. And I always like to make the point that the thing about the average employer rate is that there is no human being on earth for whom that is the contribution rate. Okay? It's an average. You've got a lot of different cost groups. So here we can see laid out on pages 19 and 20, 19 for general, 20 for safety, all of your different cost groups. Basically, what drives the cost group is the benefit formula. So you'll see the benefit structure. All the people with enhanced PEPPER Tier 4 are in cost group 1, unless they are separate employers with more than 50 participants. How many people were here during the depooling discussions? Okay, decision was made. Some of you people must have really tired arms, because I didn't see enough hands go up. The ones down here, sanitary district, housing, fire protection, these are the ones that, because of their size, were put into a separate pool. So what determines how many cost groups you have is first how many different plan formulas, and then how many employers are large enough to have their own pools. So when we look at the page of the contribution rates, you're going to see a whole string of them, and then at the bottom you'll see an average, which is everybody tied together. And probably the most interesting result in this valuation report is, even though the average rate was fairly flat and went down slightly, there was some variation. Some of the cost groups went up, some of the cost groups went down. So we'll look at that next. So I'm going to go back to the front of the report just to hammer that point home. I'm still in section one. Flip, if you will, to page Roman 5. Roman 5 in section 1. Yeah, we're going to talk about the combined rate, but I want you to see the separate rates first. So at the top of Roman 5, that's little v, where it has the average employer contribution rate, the bottom line says all employers combined. And that rate went down, average rate 39.23 down to 38.08. We're going to look at a table in section 2 that will reconcile how we got from 39.23 to 38.08. Now, John has, in his secret file, a file that we will eventually share with staff, we actually do a reconciliation for each rate group, both of the unfunded and of the cost rate. Is that right, John?
That's right.
That is right. So we actually have that, but all you've got in here is a reconciliation of that average rate. But if you just sort of run your fingers down there, you can see that for the general tiers, they all pretty much follow the average, with one exception. Small districts, cost group number 6, you'll see it went up from 25.38 to 28.88. Well, that's what you get for being small. They actually had a change in their demographics, and with a small employer, a small change in demographics can produce a fairly dramatic change in the rates. That's what happened there. For safety, now this is where we see some results going the other direction. Again, for the big county group and for Contra Costa and East Fire, the rates did go down, 76.4 to 75.6, 81, about 82 down to 77. But then you'll see here again some variation. You'll see a pretty good jump for Rodeo Hercules from 86 up to 96. That's probably the one that jumps off the page. And John, I think we did poke around to see what the details of that were. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, that employer's total payroll decreased by 16%, pretty drastic decrease. And, you know, when we calculate the unfunded accrued liability contribution rate, that's always expressed as a percent of payroll. If your payroll is a lot lower, your UAL rate will be higher.
Yeah, now one thing, again, this is both for veteran trustees and newer trustees. All these employer contribution rates, this is basic actuarial 101 a little bit. All these employer contribution rates are made up of two parts. There's a normal cost, and there's an amount to pay off the unfunded. And we have in later pages, group by group, employer by employer, where you can see separately the normal cost and the unfunded payment. The point that John made is this. The normal cost rate tends to be fairly stable. But the unfunded liability rate, first of all, that's where all of your actual experience goes. But also, that unfunded liability payment is calculated as a dollar amount, like a mortgage payment, and then divided by payroll to get the contribution rate. Well, think of your home mortgage. If you have a home mortgage and you have a certain fixed payment, and you for some reason got a 16% cut in your pay, right? Your mortgage payment in dollars would not change, but as a percentage of your income, it just went up by more or less 16%. That's what happened to Rodeo Hercules. It's not that the mortgage payment necessarily changed, but it's being spread over a smaller payroll, therefore it looks like a larger percentage. And I think if we dig around in the details and look for cost group 12, you'll be able to see that the big swing is in the unfunded liability component of the total contribution rate.
And that employer pays a flat rate anyway for their UAL, so.
Yeah, they pay a flat dollar amount.
Yeah. Okay, so that means that this is less, maybe less of a, well, again, it all depends how they do their budget. If they budget it as internally as a percentage of pay, they're going to see this. But what you're emphasizing is the fact that it really is the dollars mm-hmm. that drive the contribution rate. And I think it was with having in mind the fact that this employer had some instability in their payroll base was why the board went to the basis of framing that contribution in dollar terms.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Is CalPERS now doing that for their employers?
I believe they are.
Yeah.
They are. Yep.
Just a flat dollar.
They're still doing it as a. They still assume it grows with payroll. Mm-hmm. It's still not level dollar amortization. It's a level percentage amortization, but they're expecting them as dollars for just this reason. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so with that, what's our page number there, John? We're going to go to the reconciliation of the contribution rate, which are on page 32, section 2. And I think this is the last page we'll go through in detail. This sort, if you remember the unfunded liability page, this is very similar, has most of the same items. This is this aggregate rate. It was 29.25 beginning last year.
39.
I'm sorry, 39.25 last year. And you can see some of the same items. We had a small gain on investments after smoothing, 3 basis points. We had a gain on additional contributions because of the 18-month lag, 12 basis points. We had higher than expected salary increases. That was that loss because pay grew faster than assumed. That cost 11 points. Now, the next one is a little bit new. This did not show up in the unfunded page. This is this whole idea that if pay goes down, then your unfunded payment as a percentage of pay will go up. Well, it goes the other way. If pay goes up faster than assumed, then your unfunded liability contribution as a percentage of pay will go down, and that's 40 basis points. That's a combination of the item just above, which is higher than expected pay increases for continuing members. We also, though, had some headcount growth. Every time, we assume constant headcount. So anytime an employer adds staff, those people come on with no unfunded liability, no accrued liability, but that means that then they're taking their unfunded payment, spreading it over a larger payroll, so it lowers the rate. So that's that four, that's 39 basis points. All the other items here are exactly analogous to the items that we saw in the change of the unfunded. This just shows how it translates into contribution rates. So net-net, about 1.15 percentage of pay decrease in that average rate. But again, that's not going to mean that every single employer sees the same 1.15% decrease. Absent question, that's all I'll say about this page. So the other stuff here, you know, I'm going to look at the asset smoothing pages because I love asset smoothing. That's on page 5 and pages around it. The thing to note here is that what I like about page 5, now first of all, because we credit interest on our reserves every 6 months, even though it's 5-year smoothing, we do it in 10 six-month buckets. But what you can see here is that for the calendar year, which is the top two lines, we had a good first 6 months, but we had not so good last 6 months. Again, I'm sorry, I'm back in 2011. Let's go on the bottom of the page. Sorry about that. In 2016, you know, for the first 6 months, we had actual returns of $300 million, assumption of $240. The next 6 months were not as favorable. We had actual return of $200 million, with an assumed return of about 250. You net those two together, for the last year, it's pretty much a break-even year. And that's why the amount of smoothing, the amount of deferred gains compared to the market assets is really about the same as it was last year, about 2.5%. This is a relatively small number. That is, the smooth value and the market value are pretty close together for a plan of this size. But what that means, and we say this in the front of the report, we are deferring losses of $183 million, which means that over the next 4 years, if the market value earns exactly 7%, the assumed rate, right, then the smooth value will show a loss of $183 million. And we can even show you at the bottom when that 183 is going to hit. So again, if the market value earns exactly 7%, for the next 5 years there, we're going to see the losses at the bottom of this page. But the real key here is that these are relatively small numbers in total. And the last picture I'll show you, I have a new favorite picture, which is the one on page 34. And we'll close. You know, we have a graph in here of the smooth value and the actual value, but the problem is they're so close together it's hard to really see what's going on. But on page 34, these are not the asset values. This is your funded ratio. But it's a funded ratio on a market value basis. That's the gray squares. And the funded ratio on a smooth actuarial value basis. That's the blue diamonds. And what you can see here, well, first of all, you can see the market downturn in calendar year 2008. It's hard to miss. It's that big valley in the beginning there. And by the way, we normally have 10 years here. I'm going to have a battle with John next year because normally 2007 would drop off. I'm going to try to keep it on here because I'd like to continue to see that, so we'll just add more years. But you can really see here the housing bubble burst and the asset smoothing, that's the blue line, is doing its job. It goes down, but it wants to wait for the market value to recover, which the market value did. So then we spent those years, and you might remember in 2012 we came in and said we should all have cake because for the first time since the market burst, we now had the smoothed value was actually lower than the market value. We were deferring gains instead of deferring losses. We lived that way for a couple years, 12, 13, 14. Then in 15, we had a bad year on the market. See the gray box going down? So that, you know, slows down the growth of the smooth value, and now we're kind of in that same position. But if you look from 2010 to 2016, you see a perfect example of exactly what asset smoothing is supposed to do. When the market is up, smooth value is going to lag behind. Market's down, smooth value is going to lag from above. But overall, all we're doing is removing short-term volatility, one of the most powerful funding policy tools that you have at your disposal. And with that pitch, Mr. Chairman, I conclude our prepared remarks.
Okay, great. Any comments or questions from the trustees? Any comments or questions from...
Oh, man. Again, thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Very good. Well done.
Any public comments on this item? Seeing none, we'll...